Good morning. Call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes. We have a number of bills before us. We're going to go slightly out of order to accommodate members' schedules, which are getting busier and busier. But first, we have Senate File 293, Senator Clausen. Welcome to the committee, and we're happy to have your testimony on your bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Senate File 293 is a tax deduction tax credit proposal for contributions to the Minnesota College Savings Plan, commonly referred to as a 529 College Savings Plan. The purpose of Senate File 293 is to provide an incentive for families trying to save for future higher education expenses, which will bring down the cost of student loan debt. And Madam Chair, I do have an A4 amendment.
Do members have the A4 amendment in their packets?
Yep.
Yes. Okay, Senator Eaton moves the A4 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Minnesota's four-year graduates carry the third highest amount of debt in the United States at over $30,000. Our state also has the fifth highest percentage of students with education-related debt at 71%. 529 college savings plans allow parents, grandparents, and others to save for college costs. The Minnesota plan is operated by the Office of Higher Education and was created by the state to encourage individuals to save for post-secondary education. Earnings in the plan accrue free of Minnesota income tax, and qualified withdrawals are not subject to Minnesota income tax. Contributions to a 529 plan, however, are not deductible. The state retains ownership of the match amounts, and they may only be used for qualifying education expenses of the beneficiary at a higher education institution. Minnesota tax benefits related to the plan are available only to Minnesota taxpayers. Withdrawn funds used for college expenses are free from federal income taxes. And Minnesota is currently only one of eight states which offer a college savings plan, not offering a tax incentive for a 529 college savings plan. I'd like to review at this time some of the key provisions of the bill, starting out at Section 1, Subdivision 19B. It allows a Minnesota taxpayer to deduct up to $3,000 for a married couple filing a joint return and $1,500 for all other filers contributing to a 529 college savings plan. This is an above-the-line calculation that reduces total taxable income, in other words, a deduction. Tax filers may not claim both the subtraction and the credit allowed under Section 2. Section 2, Subdivision 1, provides definitions of 529 terminology related to Chapter 136D, which governed Minnesota College Savings Plan. And Subsection 2 defines eligibility for a 529 tax credit and also sets a maximum limit of $500 for the tax credit. Section 2, Subdivision 3, explains the credit transfer. Tax filers must have a tax refund coming in order to qualify for the credit. If a tax filer is receiving a tax refund, the 529 credit is deducted from the amount of the refund and transferred automatically to the 529 account, once again, up to $500. Section 2, Subdivision 4, requires the Office of Higher Education Commissioner to provide information to the Commissioner of Revenue in order to verify taxpayer 529 contributions. And Subdivision 5 under Section 2 imposes a penalty and identifies how the credit would be repaid if a non-qualified distribution takes place. The taxpayer is liable for the less sum of 10% of the amount of the unqualified distribution or the sum of the tax credits received over the years in a 529 plan. And Subdivision 6 under Section 2, the appropriation must be sufficient to pay refunds authorized by the credit. I would like to turn your attention to the handout from the National Conference on State Legislators. This handout provides a good overview of 529 plans. You also have been provided with a fiscal note, and with us today to provide testimony, Mr.
Senator Paul Clausen and the Tax Committee, we call them revenue estimates. Fiscal notes.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you do have a revenue note. With us today, Mr. Paul Cervenek, President and CEO of the Minnesota Private College Council and Minnesota Private College Fund, and Mr. John McGee, Vice President for Planning and Public Affairs, St. John's University. And if we could have them come forward for testimony.
Morning, gentlemen. Whoever wants to start, begin. Mr. Cervenek.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this bill. I'm Paul Cervenek, the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Private College Council is made up of 17 private, nonprofit colleges and universities here in Minnesota. The Private College Council and our member colleges support Senate File 293 because this bill will help families save for college by creating a tax incentive to encourage annual college savings. I'd like to give you just a few facts about family savings, and then I'm going to let John McGee from St. John's University and the College of St. Benedict talk more about family savings from the perspective of our colleges. But we have, I think, three slides in your packet, and the first one shows a little bit about the U.S. savings rate. From 1960 to 1985, the annual personal savings rate in the United States fluctuated between 7 and 11% of disposable personal income. However, since 1985, the savings rate has dropped substantially and now fluctuates between 2 and 7%. And then secondly, I want to tell you a little bit about savings in data from Sallie Mae. Sallie Mae reports in an annual survey how America pays for college that from 2011 to 2014, average contributions from parents' savings of all kinds, not just 529 plans, but all kinds of savings, including retirement plans and other savings, met just 9 to 15% of the total cost of attendance for their students across all types of colleges. And for families with incomes of less than $100,000, average contributions from parent savings cover just 6 to 12% of the cost of college. In a separate report, Sallie Mae also reported that only 10% of family savings is intended for college costs. This bill is important because it will provide an incentive for savings for college. Establishing an incentive is an important long-term strategy to make college more affordable for students and families and to ease the debt burden students incur in paying for college. Beyond the important benefit of incentivizing savings, this bill is also important because it helps both lower and middle-income families with the cost of college. Generally, federal and state financial aid programs like the Pell Grant and the state grant focus financial aid where the need is greatest on lower income families. However, as real family incomes have been stagnant or have fallen over the course of the last decade, college has become harder to afford for many middle class families whose incomes are not low enough to qualify them for a Pell Grant or a state grant. This bill is a tool which can help those families with the cost of college while at the same time encouraging them to save from their own resources to pay for college. Both lower-income families and middle-income families face significant gaps in their ability to pay the cost of college, gaps that necessitate borrowing and sometimes extend the time it takes to graduate, further driving up the total cost of college. Increasing savings is part of the solution to the challenge of making college affordable. Over the long run, this bill will be good for Minnesota families, and it will be good for the state. And that's why we support the bill and hope you will make it part of your package this legislative session. And then I want to ask John to talk a little more about savings from the college perspective.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is John McGee. I'm Vice President for Planning and Public Affairs for the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in central Minnesota. Among other things, I study how families pay for college, and just parenthetically, I'm also the parent of four children ages 10 to 18, so I get the value of this real soon. Savings may seem to be self-evidently good behavior, but as it turns out in the United States, that we're a nation of hopers more than we are planners. Savings rates in the United States, as Paul said, aren't good, and it's not just that people don't save at high rates, they don't save very much money. In 2014, 60% of all employed Americans over age 25 reported that the total value of their savings investments, excluding the value of their homes, and defined benefit plans that their employers held was less than $25,000. Interestingly, in the same analysis, those same people indicated that they would likely be well prepared for retirement. That seems highly unlikely. Fewer than a third reported savings in excess of $50,000 in 2014 compared to 36% in 2009, meaning the amount that people are saving today is actually lower than it was at the tail end of the recession. The most recent data from the Federal Reserve Board's triennial survey of consumer finances indicates that only 53% of all Americans say that they save anything at all, and only 4 in 10 of all American families say that they save by intent. That is, they plan to set aside money. Some percentage claim savings, but it's only because there happens to be money left over at the end of the month. Not surprisingly, fewer than half of all families who make less than $50,000 a year report saving anything. Single-parent families are among the least likely to save, with only 40% saving anything. But even in two-parent families, with children, only 57% save. Two factors have conspired, I think, to reduce savings in the United States. The first is that Americans spend a lot. This is a consumer culture. It's a consumer economy. Three-quarters of our GDP is driven by consumer spending. We need people to spend in the United States, and as it turns out, we do. And we do an awful lot of it by credit. Outstanding consumer credit in the United States was $350 billion in 1980. By 2012, it was $2.6 trillion. Even adjusted for inflation, that's an extraordinary increase in the course of about a generation and a half. More importantly, though, wage growth simply hasn't kept up, and that has made it more difficult to save. Since the year 2000, median family income in the United States has not kept pace with inflation, and has fallen by 11% in inflation-adjusted terms since the year 2000. The median purchasing power of family income today is about what it was in 1995, which coincidentally is the year that our first-year students who enrolled last fall were born. At St. Ben's and St. John's, they did an analysis of reported financial resources that our families had that were not in retirement accounts and excluding home equity, and the average amount that our families reported that they had available in savings and checking accounts was less than $20,000. It's about $16,000 among College of St. Benedict students and $18,000 among St. John's University students. And those resources are for all expenses, not simply for college. That's just not enough. That's not enough for college. That's not enough for life. And I don't have any reason to believe, actually I did work at the Minnesota Private College Council for 6 years, that it's different at other institutions. Savings rates notwithstanding, the typical reward for not choosing or not being able to save, particularly for middle-income or even upper-middle-income families, is the opportunity to borrow more. The college finance stool rests on four legs: current family income, family savings, student and parent borrowing, and institutional and government grants and scholarships. Institutional grants and scholarships can't be known until the point of application. I don't know for my 10-year-old what will be available in institutional grants and scholarships 8 years from now. I don't know what my income will be 8 years from now. I can't predict that precisely. It's particularly difficult to anticipate when children are very young. But what I can do is choose to save. It's the one part of the financing stool that I have control of early on in my children's lives. I can control it, I can manage it, and I can plan it. As somebody who spent a lot of time in birthing centers over the course of a number of years, it's a terrific time to start thinking about saving and saving for college, and a great time to get information about that, though most people don't think about that at that moment. But 18 years goes by quite quickly.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Senator Gazelka, do you have questions of these people? Because we have two other testifiers.
It's more for the senator, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. I support the direction of trying to encourage people to do 529 plans. I guess I'm I wondering from the Senator, and I've talked to Senator Clausen about why it's not beyond Minnesota, that we only have it, the credit for Minnesota plans.
Senator Clausen.
Madam Chair and Senator Gazalka, this has been a discussion item that we've had. There are currently only five states that open it up, as you're suggesting. The other concern is the revenue note. What is the implications of opening it up further where people could invest in other state savings plans and then have that tax deduction here in Minnesota? I'm certainly open to reviewing that with the committee at their request. But those are some of my reservations about why the bill is structured the way it is.
Senator Claus, when you say that there are only five other states that open it up, what do you mean by that statement?
Madam Chair, meaning that a person could invest, let's say, in a Massachusetts plan living here in Minnesota and could deduct that from their contribution from the Massachusetts plan on the Minnesota tax. Right now it's structured. You can only use this tax credit or tax deduction if you're investing in the Minnesota plan
No, I understand what the legislation does, but mm-hmm. what when you said five other states allow out-of-state, so the state of Massachusetts has some sort of tax benefit for Massachusetts residents who invest in some plan that is not the Massachusetts state plan. Is that what you mean?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so five states allow their residents to invest in outside of the state. Ms. Pollock.
Madam Chair.
Clear that up for me.
As Senator Clausen mentioned, there are five other states that allow the deduction for contributions to plans organized under any other state. And those are Pennsylvania, Arizona, Maine, Missouri, and Kansas.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, one more.
Yeah. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. And I was going to offer an amendment towards this, but I'd really rather have it more a discussion of our committee.
Senator Gazelka, that's why I was hoping we could wait for the discussion to hear from the other witnesses.
Okay. Well, okay. Just one last comment on this, because there's a Morningstar report from 2013 that ranks college savings plans, and there's a few that they say maybe you should consider rolling out of, and Minnesota's 529 plan is one of them, number. And they have made some modifications, which I hope will move them out of that, but that's why I'm concerned.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Senator Scoy.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I know you want to get to the testifiers, but just so I understand the nature of the 529 plan, if you invest in a Massachusetts plan from Minnesota, can you then use those resources in any state?
Yes.
Any state?
Yes.
So it really is just a financial location.
Yes. Yep. Any further comments from you gentlemen?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, other testifiers, if you would come forward, if you want to speak on this bill, please. Is this guy not here? Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Peach, Meyer Price Financial. I'm the Senior Vice President of Public Affairs and Community Relations. I'm also here representing the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council today. Robin Rowan is unavailable. She's in another committee. So my knowledge of fashion sense and popular culture is greatly diminished compared to hers. So I'm going to stick to the 529 plan testimony today.
Fine.
Thank you for having us here today. I represent a Minnesota company, Ameriprise Financial. We have 700 financial advisors in Minnesota alone that represent clients in nearly every part of the state. Most of our clients have two main goals when they come to us. They're primarily concerned with saving for retirement. That's obviously their ultimate goal. But saving for education is their number two goal. It's also probably their highest emotional goal. Getting their kids off to a good head start in life is one of the most important things. They're seeing college costs rising. They're seeing their incomes being stagnant. They're trying to figure out how to best pay for this education for their kids. So tax incentives are critical to help. The 529 plan is one of the most effective vehicles to help people save for college education. It lets income grow tax-free. It's a really powerful tool. So anything we can do that's going to help drive more people into the 529 plan is going to be critical to the success of people saving for college education, reducing student debt, and helping more people achieve the American dream. We think this is really important, and we absolutely support things that drive people into 529 plans. Right now, 34 states allow deductions for 529 plans. There are actually six that have an open system that let it go to any other state plan. The prevailing trend legislatively, however, is to open the plans up. What people are finding is that their constituents want freedom of choice. People don't want to be driven to the state-only plan because it takes the competition out of the marketplace. So we have six states right now this year that are considering legislative action to make their plans open. California is one of the biggest states in the country for 529 plans. Right now they're working on moving their state to an open system, as is New Jersey and Ohio, and we have six, and a seventh one is going to be joining us next week and moving for parity. We think it's critically important to let our clients choose from the best plans in the marketplace that meet their needs. You can pick the plan that has the highest return and the lowest fees. We think that that is absolutely critical, and it helps people create choice in how they save for education. One of the things that's we support the concept of this bill, but as a closed system, this is detrimental to Minnesota consumers and it's detrimental to Minnesota companies. What happens in this system under the bill, if it's not allowed to go to any 529 plan, it has to go to the Minnesota plan, it would be really difficult for a financial advisor to look at a client and say, there are all these other plans out there that are better. You should go to one of those when Minnesota's offering a tax deduction, a tax credit to go into their bill. From a suitability perspective, you almost always come out slightly ahead by taking the state plan that has the deduction, but that forces people into a plan that's not necessarily the best for them. What happens then for the second biggest pot of money that our clients are accumulating? If you're a financial advisor and you're working with one of your clients and they come to you and say, I want a 529 plan, college savings is important, and we have no choice but to say, you have to go into the Minnesota plan, it's the only one you get the tax credit for. And they're like, oh, great, help me invest in that. Help me look at the subaccounts to figure out how to maximize my investment and choices. We're prohibited from doing that because it's not a product that our financial advisors are authorized to sell or give advice on, as is other financial advisors. That's not unique to my company. So you're taking people that have their second biggest pot of money with their highest emotional tie to it and saying, good luck. We hope you guys can figure this out on your own. That's contrary to everything that we believe in as a company. We believe in providing financial advice to help people navigate the tricky waters of investment. And we think that this having it as an open plan lets us pick the very best plans for our customers. It helps us get higher returns and lower fees and helps lower student debt ultimately. If you look at what's happened in the marketplace with regard to 529 plans and the Minnesota plan, Senator Gazelka mentioned the Morningstar article. It's a horribly rated plan. They made some changes by cutting fees, so it's been upgraded to a neutral performance plan, and just based on the hope that the fee structure will make it better. Right now, there are 29 plans that Morningstar rates that are rated as gold, silver, or bronze. Minnesota got rated neutral and was called serviceable. Quite frankly, I want to put my clients in something that's better than serviceable. I want to put them in something that's gold, silver, or bronze. It's going to help them save more money for college. When you look at what's happened, though, in the marketplace right now, people can go to any plan in Minnesota because there's no tax incentive for the Minnesota plan. In 2014, the Minnesota plan had 2012, the Minnesota plan had 20,152 people making contributions. They put $96.1 million into the plan. Morningstar starts ranking them. It shows how poorly the plan is performing. In 2014, that number dropped to 18,200 participants with $76 million in contributions. Savings is going up from 2012 to 2014. The economy is going better. People are investing more. So it's not a factor of people not having the money. They're putting it in plans that are better suited for them and that are getting higher returns. Nobody wants to invest in the bottom of the barrel because we can't afford it. So we believe that opening this up is absolutely critical. And what I will say, I think that we need to think about the revenue estimate on this. These tax incentives are going to drive more people into the and credits to get more people into the 529 marketplace. Whether they invest in the Minnesota-only plan because they're forced to, or they invested in any other plan, isn't going to make a difference in the number of people that participate. It's going to make a difference in the number how the allocations flow out. But the incentives you're creating is going to drive participation. It's going to encourage people to do it. But whether it's an open system or a closed system, and what we're finding in the other states, that doesn't make a difference in the number of people that necessarily participate. It's relatively the same universe. So thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions? Senator Clausen, have you done this bill before? This is not a new idea for you, is it?
Madam Chair, we did introduce this in 2013.
And Senator Clausen, do you recall, was it limited to the Minnesota College Savings Plan at that time?
At that time, Madam Chair, no, it was not.
And what was the revenue estimate? Do you remember the magnitude of it? Maybe not exactly.
I believe it may be Ms. Pollack would know, but it seems to me it was twice what the revenue note is currently.
Ms. Pollack, do you happen to have that 2013, Ms. McQuay, do you happen to have the 2013 estimate?
Madam Chair and members, we did not, I don't have in my file, I guess I should say, a revenue estimate from 2013, and we could have gotten it at that time, but basically what revenue is suggesting is that 79% of all contributions to qualified tuition programs are made through brokers to 529 plans other than the Minnesota College Savings Plan. So there's
could extrapolate.
Yes,
there.
That it's about three times as large, three or four times.
Would you repeat that,
and,
please?
Senator Clausen, apparently your bill at that time, in trying to kind of guess what the estimate would be, did not have the credit in it, Ms. Pollack.
That's correct,
yeah.
Madam Chair.
Mr.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have the revenue estimate from the previous bill.
Okay.
The previous bill was open to anybody, and I think we have to keep in mind with the revenue estimate, we were looking at a different level of credits or a different level
yes.
of deduction. It was a $10,000 per couple and $5,000 per individual.
And what was that?
That was $9.9 million. And so this year we're looking at $3,000 per couple, $1,500 per individual, and so
and we get $9.3 million for that.
But the one before did not have the credit attached to it.
Yes,
and the credit's the more expensive part of the current revenue.
So that, if just trying to kind of massage this
exactly.
Senator Clausen, the credit limited to the Minnesota College Plan is $7.2 million subtraction. If you look at the revenue estimate, is 2.1. So the credit turns out to be more of a tax benefit. But all of this, because of looking at your bill in 2013 and the one this time, it's obviously scalable. I mean, you can decide on what amount you can back into it. If let's say we said, oh, this is a really great idea, we're going to make it worth $6 million a year spread between the credit and the subtraction, then we would just, we could go to an adjustment for how much would be allowed and then whether we would want it to be an open plan. But it looks like it's not an order of magnitude that the bill, even with the subtraction that was with the open plans, cost $50 million. I mean, that is not the order of magnitude here. So we may want to work with counsel and the fiscal analyst to see if there are some other combinations and consider opening it, even though Senator Gozell could not have an amendment today. I do think there may be a good argument of allowing more choice, and also seems to be a trend in other states to do that as well. And full disclosure, I will say that I do invest in the Minnesota College Saving Plan, and quite frankly, I'm satisfied with it. So it's not a matter of looking at some other plan, 529 and that. I'm satisfied with the return I get. So are there further questions? Is there someone here from the Minnesota College Plan?
I'm here from the Office of Higher Education.
The Office of Higher Education. Now, if you would like to come forward and are you Mr. Helgeson?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Please, sir, give us your testimony. And identify yourself, please.
Yes. First. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Helgeson. My official title is the Audit Manager at the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, but I also am the Contract Manager for the Minnesota College Savings Plan and am the primary contact with our plan manager, TIA CREF. I'd just like to respond to some of the testimony that I've heard here and offer our perspective on that. The Morningstar 2014 report did, in fact, move us, our plan, from one of the two worst in the country, along with Kansas, up to being a neutral plan. Two of the main drivers in the Morningstar analysis are the fees assessed to the plan account owners and whether there's a tax incentive or not present in the state. During our last RFP process, which we concluded with a new contract with TIA CREF as our plan manager in August, those fees were cut by 50%. They were charging about 30 basis points to the account owners. That's been dropped to 15. So we made substantial progress on the fees, which puts us in line with a number of other states. So the missing piece was the tax incentive, which is what we're talking about here today. We have seen increasing contributions since that was signed. We've been our plan manager has been quite aggressive in rolling out and advertising the new lower fees, and we've even seen some rollovers coming into the plan since mid-August. So we are excited about that, and it's important to get contributions into the Minnesota plan because the more assets are that are under management by your plan manager, it drives the fees for your plan account owners down. We already have in a contract, if we hit certain benchmarks, that the management fee will drop another basis point. We've got two of those benchmarks already in the signed contract that we have that goes through 2019. Our current assets under the plan are about $1.16 billion, and I believe the next benchmark might be $1.35. I don't think it goes to 1.5, but so the more we can get into our plan, that will benefit all of the account owners, existing and new, in the plan. The philosophy of our Minnesota plan from the start, and this goes back to my predecessor Jack Rayburn, who was there from the beginning and set it up, was to keep the plan relatively simple. It is a direct sold plan, so no, you do not go to a financial advisor or broker to purchase this. You either phone in, go on the website, or fill out a form and send it in to TIA CREF. You can open an account with as little as $25, and if you elect to use the payroll deduction option, you can take out as little as $15 out of each paycheck and continue to contribute. We have not offered as broad a range of investment options as some other states. However, we do offer the entire spectrum of risk from a guaranteed option where you are guaranteed to keep your contributions and a small amount of guaranteed interest between 1% to 3% each year if you are very conservative, or you can go into a full-blown equities account where you're totally invested in the stock market, so you and everything in between. The most popular option in our plan is an age-based plan where you put your money into the account, and based on the age of your child at that time, the assets are your funds are invested in a mix of assets and asset classes, such that when your child is, if they're a newborn, they'll be more aggressive, more in the market, and as they reach towards age 17 and 18, when you're going to need those funds, they will be more conservatively invested to prevent market risk at that time. About three-fourths of the assets in the Minnesota plan are in that age-based progression, which it's one of those where you set it and forget it, and it goes on through the age cycle of your child. Part of the philosophy of keeping things relatively simple and limiting the investment options, we did not want people to look at this laundry list of investment options and become essentially paralyzed at, you know, how am I going to do this? What am I going to do? So I'm not going to open an account at all. So we'd rather have them open an account, pick out some level of risk that they feel is appropriate for them, and they can make changes. As of December, when a new federal law was passed, they can change their investment options twice per year if they do want to move things around. Part of that philosophy also was, if you look at our returns on the plan, we readily admit that during the great times in the stock market, some of our investment options did not hit the highest highs, but during the recession, when things bottomed out, we also did not hit the lowest of the lows. So we are trying to take a relatively safe approach with our account owners' investments for college savings. So we've tried to stick to that general philosophy. Many of the investment options that are offered, though, do tend to be not actively managed. They tend to be a passive or an index-based fund, which in that case you're tracking the, say, the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones. And so there, as the market goes up, you're just going to follow along with it. If the market goes down and you're that in that option, you're going to follow along with that. But that also keeps fees down. When you don't have someone actively moving assets around as a broker or market, you're not going to have as many fees attached to that option. So that's a cheaper option for people. And some of the most popular plans in the country are almost all index funds. A couple of the other things I will mention, California was mentioned as a state that might go to tax parity, meaning you can invest in any, you can put your money into any plan in the country and still get some sort of a tax deduction or tax credit as a California taxpayer. Right now, California is in the same boat that Minnesota is. They have no tax incentive whatsoever. A year ago, this did come up in the California legislature, and the original plan was to only provide a tax incentive for investments in the California plan. And I know from people who were involved in that process is that when the opening up and the tax parity issue was brought up, that essentially scuttled that discussion in the California legislature because of the increased cost. There was too much disagreement within the legislature, and eventually that bill was just lost, which meant nothing was available to the citizens of California, which is where we stand today. So I just wanted to point that out. And another thing that we feel is important is we really want to get to the lower income people, and Senator Claussen's bill has some things in it that would allow even a family who makes very little income could set aside, if they could find $25 in a year to put into an account and get some sort of a tax credit to add on to that, we would like those families, by the time the child is 18, even if they have $500 set aside in an account marked for college. That has been shown by numerous studies that knowing that you have that as you go along, those children are in the mindset of, I'm going to get some sort of post-secondary education. And so when I use the word college, I'm talking, that can be anything, a two-year, a technical, whatever it might be. And so we really want to encourage even the lower-income people to take advantage of this. So I'll stop with that, but if there are any questions, I'd be happy to entertain those.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. It was interesting information. I'm going to call on Senator Gazelka. I guess the department wants to make a comment, but we're going to end the discussion on this bill in the next few minutes because other people have schedules to meet, and I think we've had a full discussion. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Me being one of them with another committee meeting. Right. But I'm glad that you do it at $25 a month. That will help, you know, some of the other folks out there. But my concern is we have to ask the question, what's best for the consumer? And to only have one option, to me, is a mistake. Where the financial planners are can be very, very helpful, of which at one time I did have my securities license. I do not now. But they provide expertise, and they evaluate suitability, which investment is best. And many, many, many people don't know which way to go. And to just say this is the only way to go, and you put the money in, that to me is a problem. And so when we look at, you know, what's best for the consumer, this plan still will be successful. And by giving the credit, your funds will probably still go up, but there'll be an even larger amount of dollars that are going into 529s, and that's a win for the consumer.
Mr. Cummings?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I just wanted to be very clear, Madam Chair, that the administration is not taking a position on this bill.
Okay. That was all. Well, that might be a win for the legislature. Who knows?
Yes, and I can say that I'm not speaking on behalf of Commissioner.
No, you're giving us information.
Yes,
we understand that completely. Yes. No, don't worry about it. Any further discussion? Senator Clausen, you can see that we're interested in your bill. We probably want to look at some other permutations of it.
Yep. Madam Chair, we will definitely work on that. I think the important thing is that we want to put this in place, and it's a great benefit to all of Minnesotans, and will help pay for that college expense.
Right. Okay. With no further discussion, Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 293 be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say as amended. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator, we're going to Senator Nelson next, Senator Chamberlain, because she has a time bind, but she promises to be brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
there is a A1 amendment in your packets on behalf of Senator Nelson. Senator Dietzick moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Nelson, we have now Senate File 304 before us as amendment, as amended, summary reflects the amendment, and the revenue estimate reflects the amendment. Okay, the revenue estimate is not altered by your amendment offered on your behalf. It was a technical amendment, clarifying language or something. So, Senator Nelson, Senate File 304.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I just have to say that was quite an interesting discussion. And
was,
as a financial, someone in the financial industry myself, I certainly was tempted to join in. But this bill is very straightforward. Basically, it
just a moment. Yes. I wonder if you could take your conversations out of the room back there. Okay, go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill is very straightforward. I'll just say about two sentences about why it's important. This legislature and people all across Minnesota, really in the nation, have realized how important early childhood education is, and particularly making sure that when kids get to kindergarten, they are prepared and ready to learn. And we've done a lot of things in this body to try and encourage. And we've made some success in seeing more children prepared and ready to learn when they get to kindergarten. Senate File 304 is just another attempt to try and to make it easier for moms and dads to be able to send their child to a pre-kindergarten experience. And the bill actually does two things. Well, in general, it's one item, and that is it extends the current subtraction and credit that we allow under current law for K-12 education-related expenses It simply extends that to pre-kindergarten expenses. And I think it fits hand in hand with many of the other initiatives that this legislature has done that we hope to do in the future. And basically, in a nutshell, that's it, Madam Chair. I'd certainly be glad to go through in greater detail, but it simply extends the credit and subtraction that we have to pre-kindergarten.
So, Senator Nelson, it's not expanding the eligible expenses. It's keeping the eligible expenses in check. It's keeping in check to make sure that there's no, quote, double dipping. You can't take the deduction or credit now for if you have a pre-tax account that you're paying for childcare or something. It's not allowed there. How do you determine what is daycare and what is education?
Oh, that is a very good question, Madam Chair. And you will find that on page 2 of the legislation. I'll just briefly read for you. We do define what is a pre-kindergarten educational program. So it's not just daycare. It's pre-kindergarten educational program. And you will see on lines 2.3 through 2.10. And as someone who's been really a leader and early adopter of this high-quality early preschool, that was something that I looked for and wanted to make sure was included. So basically, if it's a pre-kindergarten program established by a school district, if it's licensed by DHS and accredited by the National Association for Education of Young Children or the National Early Childhood Program Accreditation, if it's a Montessori program affiliated and or accredited with American Montessori Association or American Montessori International. And finally, if it's a child care program provided by family daycare providers holding a current early childhood development credential approved by the Commissioner of Human Services. So I think what we have there is a very high-quality, educational-focused pre-kindergarten experience.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Nelson? I think it's pretty straightforward inclusion. And obviously, the governor, both houses, both parties are really interested in, in particularly the four-year-old education programs. However, this bill doesn't limit it to four-year-olds, right?
Oh, Madam Chair,
thank you.
That is correct. One could see 1-, 2-, and 3-year-olds as well, although there is the criteria
right
that would need to be met. And
might
so
be
I,
hard to
it might be hard I do
to
believe,
justify
yes
this for a one-year-old.
Yes.
But
the bill does allow for the years, for those ages, if in fact it meets the criteria regarding educational quality.
And the you can't double dip on the pre-tax account, and you can't double dip on the dependent care credit either.
Yes, so. Madam Chair, and thank you for making that clear. There is no double dipping in this
period
bill.
Right. Further questions for Senator Nelson? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 304 as amended be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
And Senator Pratt, are you within my voice? We'll take you, and then we'll give Senator Nelson the rest of the time for this hearing. Chamberlain, I'm sorry. While he's coming forward, we do have the amendments or minutes. Are there any corrections? Senator Eaton moves approval of the minutes from March 9th. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendments are approved. Senator Pratt brings us Senate File 1109.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before we begin, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Senator Ortman, on his behalf, offers the A3 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. It looks to be a lengthy amendment, so even though we've adopted it, I hope you will indicate its effects during your testimony. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the revenue note is drafted to the amended bill.
The revenue note is drafted to the amended bill. Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate File 1109 is a very simple bill. It provides a tax credit to educators that obtain their master's degree, but for those that obtain a master's degree in their area of licensure, so that it provides a depth of knowledge and expertise in a subject area rather than more of the general administrative and pedagogical courses. What the amendment does is really help to clarify that we want it to be that, and also to make sure that we do cover elementary teachers, that their master's degree can be in an area where if they teach multiple subjects, they can choose a subject that they teach. And so it does, in fact, the original bill, we were afraid, limited it to predominantly secondary schools. And really clarifying what content area means. So with me I have Dr. Eric Jolly of the Minnesota Science Museum and Jim Bartholomew of Business Partnership. But the impetus of this bill is, again, to help our teachers, our educators in the classroom, become more expert in the subjects that they teach. Of the master's degrees that our teachers have, 94% are in education or education programming, and only 6% really focus on an area where our teachers are getting depth of knowledge and expertise. So this proposal simply provides a tax credit to teachers who are becoming experts in their fields. And if you look at the revenue note, it explains some of those statistics and also shows that we're talking about a very modest tax increase. We expect it to be $160,000 in fiscal year 18 and $170,000 in fiscal year 19. And with that, I think you'd rather hear from my expert testifiers.
Well, we might have some questions. I have a question.
Sure.
So in your bill, would someone who is in a program at a university, a graduate program at a university that offers a degree, a Master of Arts in the teaching of English, where half of the credits have to be subject matter literature courses and the other half have to be in the history of education, whatever, they would not be eligible. Is that correct?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Why?
What we want them to do is become a master in reading and literature rather than continue to focus on the pedagogical. We want them to
become. What if 3/4 of the degree was in their subject matter and only 1/4 of it was in education, but the title of the degree was a Master of Arts in the teaching of mathematics at the high school level? What's the matter with that?
Madam Chair, that wasn't something that I had really considered, and I think it's something that we can certainly take offline and discuss and refine.
I think you should think about that.
Thank you.
Being the holder of one of those degrees.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd
as
like
well
to,
as a subject matter one, I mean, you know, but I think there's some gray area in with regard to the content of the program that there are some graduate programs that are a master's of education and there's no subject matter content courses that are required in order to obtain that degree, but there are lots of hybrids that might be in the service of the goal that you're after, which is increased education within a subject matter degree. But there is a lot out there that's in between none and 100%.
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I'd like to ask Dr.
Sure.
Jolly for his testimony because
He's looked at some research that is really the basis for what we're trying to move forward.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I'm Dr. Eric Jolly, President of the Science Museum of Minnesota. I am also the Chair of the National Academy of Sciences Expert Panel on STEM Education and After School. I also serve on the National Academy of Engineering Panel for K-12 Education. My testimony today is based on research from the next generation of teachers at the Harvard Graduate School, the National Commission on Teaching and America's Future, the Stanford Center for Opportunity and Policy Education on Teacher Education, the Centers for American Progress, and the Alliance for Excellence in Education, as well as my authored reports, Engagement Capacity and Continuity, and Upping the Numbers Using Quantitative-Based Decision-Making to Increase the Participation of Women, Minorities, and Persons with Disabilities in the Advanced Science Disciplines. My work is on this research. And I am delighted that the state is considering Senate File 1109 and its amendment for several reasons. One is that the research, and research is rarely clear. Research is rarely 100%. But the research and its preponderance for this shows that if our measure is student achievement is best advanced by disciplinary knowledge of the teachers in their degree field. That's where we increase student achievement. We also increase, with a master's degree, teacher retention. Teacher retention is one of the largest problems facing the state of Minnesota in its future. We crossed the line in the United States only a few years ago where time to degree now exceeds time in profession. We know that the longer a teacher is retained, the higher student outcome is. So I am delighted, as the Science Museum of Minnesota, being perhaps the only museum in the world with public policy in its mission statement, to be here today to encourage research-based decision-making in our House and Senate for supporting the improvement of education for all of our students. Our focus at the Science Museum is student outcome, student achievement. And as we work with teachers and teacher professional development, I know that, Madam Chair, you have helped testify in support of our programs. Our measure is how well the students do after we have trained the teachers. We want happy teachers. We want well-educated teachers. But we want all of that with a focus on the student and student outcome. So the research would say that a master's degree in education or an education-specific discipline will increase teacher retention and at a lower rate, therefore, increase student outcome. But the biggest amount of impact on student outcome immediately comes from highly advanced disciplinary knowledge. And so programs that have more and more teacher focused on learning in the discipline, mathematics, sciences, literature, increase student outcome. The research would also indicate that this effect is far stronger in the sciences and mathematics than it is in other disciplines.
Are there comments or questions for Senator Pratt or his first testifier? We'll get to Mr. Bartholomew. I do want to welcome to the committee room Representative Erdahl, who is Senator Pratt's House author. Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To Senator Pratt, or Dr. Jolly, is it?
Yes.
Can you just comment why a tax credit and why not a scholarship program or loan forgiveness? We're hearing lots of different things about encouraging more education. I'm trying to figure out, are we doing all of them, one of them? Should we focus on one more than the other? Because otherwise we're going to end up with this haphazard approach to trying to encourage more education.
Senator Pratt.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Ortman. The reason for looking at a tax credit here is that we're talking about a broad-based program. When we're talking about loan forgiveness, particularly in the higher ed division that we sit on, those are more targeted to specific needs where we have teacher shortages, where we have areas where we need to maybe encourage, where there are challenges getting people to migrate and stay in certain areas. This is a more broad-based approach. We want our teachers to get
master's degrees. In fact, 57% of our teaching staff have master's degrees today, and they continue to get them. What we want to do is, Dr. Jolly said, is encourage more of them to get degrees in their area of emphasis. And that's why I think we're looking at the tax credit rather than in any sort of loan forgiveness. Also, since the master's degrees are often accumulated over time, you may not see the type of loan activity taken out that you would as you're going for your baccalaureate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Senator. Can you also comment on the scholarship as an option, a scholarship program?
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's an interesting idea. I think the scholarship program, and I'm presuming you're talking through the Office of Higher Ed, we've got teachers where they're following master's degrees in administration and other disciplines within education that they may decide to move to this program or may decide to do this in supplement of that. And so rather than creating a new scholarship program, it seems to me we should be rewarding teachers for the choices that they make rather than putting additional grant and scholarship money out there. And so teachers do, in fact, in most cases, see an increase in salary when they achieve their master's degree. You're all familiar with steps and lanes. I get a step for my years of experience in a school district, and I get a lane based on my continuing my credits or my attainment of a degree. And so it seems like the tax refund approach in my or credit approach in my opinion is probably the best way to incent that.
Senator Ortman.
Just a comment. I agree on the goal. I'm just not sure I agree on the method because I'm usually pretty skeptical when it comes to tax credits. Because there's a more direct method usually than a tax credit that ends up being sort of off the books, right? We have our direct appropriations and we have our budgets, but all these tax credits means we're not raising that much in revenue, and we don't clearly see all those tax credits when we adopt our budget. So it's out of that concern and not one for your goal. I completely agree with your goal. Let's just I hope to consider further what's the best method for encouraging these teacher students to get their master's to help their teaching skills.
Mr. Bartholomew, would you identify yourself, please, for the record, and we'll hear your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and it's never fun to follow Dr.
You're going to have to bring the mic closer and speak louder. This room is not known for its acoustics.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership.
That was not an improvement. Bring it closer and use your outside voice.
My apologies, Madam Chair. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. We're here in support of Senate File 1109. And I won't repeat a lot of what Dr. Jolly said other than to say that we're familiar with the research that he cited and that it is fairly clear that teachers that are stronger in their content area are more likely to be able to help their children, students, succeed. And partly in response to Senator Ortman's comments, we think this is a sound complement to another state policy, the Alternative Teacher Compensation, or QCOMP, laws that to encourage more teachers to build on their content knowledge. You know, that should be one way, as Senator Pratt had mentioned, the steps and lanes. If we could look at restructuring the incentives through the lane process, that'd be a sound way to go. But in lieu of that, or in addition to, we think the tax credit approach that's proposed here is a good way to go. So, thank you.
Okay, further comments for Senator Pratt or Mr. Bartholomew, Senator Eaton.
Actually, my question, Madam Chair, is for Dr. Jolly.
Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you. Dr. Jolly, I was wondering if you could cite the study that you were speaking of that produce the information that the longer teachers retrain is retained, the greater the student outcome. And the perfect.
Dr. Jolling?
Madam Chair, Senator, the National Commission for Teaching and America's Future, the NCTAF in Washington, D.C., published in 2002 and then recited in similar research at the Alliance for Excellence in Education in July of 2014. Their report is titled On the Path to Equity, Improving the Effectiveness of Beginning Teachers, and they reference back to the original work that shows that the longer a teacher is in their position, the better students achieve generally. There is high variability among teachers with seniority of more than 10 years. But more than 5 years, we start to see student achievement.
10 years.
After 10 years, there is student achievement, but there's also, we see a dispersal of quality. It's a broader base, what we would call a platycurtic curve, meaning you've got high achievers and low achievers, and on average, we're feeling better. The line of a statistician is, a statistician is a person who, with one head in their head in the oven and their feet in the freezer, on average feels just fine. And so I'm always cautious about platycurtic data.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further discussion of Senate File 1109? Seeing none, Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 1109 be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion? As amended, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Pratt. Senator Chamberlain, we have two bills for you, and we're going to start with the lower number with your agreement, Senate File 271.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I was going to suggest the same thing.
And Senator Chamberlain, does your bill need an amendment at all?
Yes, Madam Chair. Author's amendment. It's titled A1.
Okay. The A1 amendment. Senator Dietzick moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Chamberlain.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Madam Chair.
Present your bill.
Madam Chair, quickly, the amendment just changes the effective date to calendar year 2015, starts as of 2015. That's all that does. It removes some obstacles and some confusion.
Senator Chamberlain, I'm yes. informed that there has to be an oral amendment to
amendment.
Ms. Pollack, do you know what that language is? And Senator Dietzick will move it on his behalf.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Madam Chair and members, to the A1 amendment on line 1.3, after 2014, insert, comma, and before January 1, 2020, period, and then delete section 2.
Everybody understand the amendment? And Senator Chamberlain will explain it in the context of his bill later. Senator Dietzick moves that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment to the A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
271.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for allowing us to come back. Last year, you may recall, we were from the tax committees presenting a similar bill, and we have certainly appreciated the discussion and the progress we made on this issue of dyslexia, helping out these families and these kids. The work continues, so we brought before you today a couple of changes to the current legislation. We have removed the requirement for the IEP. That was kind of a difficult gateway to kind of a difficult hoop to jump through for most parents. It was pretty much blocked the use of the credit. We extended the sunset to 2020, end of 2019. So it's effective through 2019, December 31st. And we've increased the credit and extended it. The credit goes from $2,000 to $3,000 for the reading, and we extended it to include other reading deficiencies in spelling. So those are the highlights. Those are the changes. Builds on the core last year, And again, the object here is we understand this is not the perfect solution, it's not the ideal solution, it is not a final solution, and is not permanent. But in the attempt to get some help, some temporary help to parents and these dyslexic kids who are receiving virtually no help in the schools today, we're hoping to get the credit extended and have it create some impact for the parents. So that's it in a nutshell. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Rachel Berger to follow up on that. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. We are happy to have your testimony. If you'd identify yourselves, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Rachel Berger. I'm the chair of Decoding Dyslexia. We're a group of parents, teachers, and other advocates who are trying to make some change for these children. So as a parent, and I'm sure all of you can attest to this, you know, we love our kids, and we do anything for them to help them to succeed. But the group that we have, most commonly what I hear is you have a group of parents who aren't getting the help that they need within our schools, despite being taxpayers and feeling that, you know, reading being a core fundamental of our educational system should be something that they're receiving in school. I'd like to take my hat off as the chair of our group for a moment and tell you personally what that's like. My son was diagnosed with dyslexia in kindergarten, and I thought I was lucky. I thought that finally, after a couple of years of not knowing quite what was going on with him, I had an answer. And I was certain that going to school, I was going to receive everything I needed. I mean, there's 30 years of data out there that supports what exactly a dyslexic child needs to be a success. Little did I know that going to the school with my diagnosis in hand at kindergarten, knowing exactly what these his struggles would be, that was the beginning of my battle. You see, our schools aren't systematically set up to help a child with dyslexia. And I'm not blaming anyone, but here's the path. You either aren't recognized, don't qualify, and therefore are left to struggle invisibly, and you essentially are left behind, even though we have no child left behind, or you have a diagnosis, and if you're lucky, you qualify for some services within our school, but guess what? Those aren't services that are specific to meet the reading instruction needs of a dyslexic child. So my husband and I had a huge decision to make, and that was one that came at a huge financial and emotion burden. But being parents, we knew what we needed to do to see our son succeed, and we took upon that responsibility. The concern I have is with people that are out there that don't have these options. The children that are there struggling invisibly every day without the services they need, the kids are frustrated. They're the ones that are doing the work. They are doing the work. They're frustrated. Their parents are frustrated. They're not making any progress, and they're not getting the help they need. So they're forced, while their taxes pay for a public education, they're forced to leave the schools and find another solution. Again, that comes at a huge financial, emotional, and time consequence to a family. And I can assure you that, you know, I'm a parent of three kids. My other two sons who don't have dyslexia are very frustrated with the money that goes out the door, the things that they can't participate in because of that. But, hey, you know, we're a family. So the achievement gap and scores are on everyone's minds. Recent NAEP score, which is the National Report Card, for 2014, stated that only 41% of fourth grade students could read proficiently. Wow. That's a problem. And I think that's a problem that all of us have to be part of. I'm asking you today to please acknowledge the complications within our system, to please not continue to have the parents bear the emotional and financial burdens alone for these children, And for these kids, I ask that you be part of the solution to help open the door and to help change the trajectory for them. And with that, I'd like to introduce to you Jane Conlin, who is with us today and has a lot of experience in our schools.
Welcome to the committee, and the representative from the Department of Revenue needs to be over in the House for the House Tax Committee. I wonder if we could hear his comments first, and then we'll come back to the testimony on the bill. Is that agreeable, Senator Chamberlain?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings? And then we'll invite you, Ms. Berger, to come back to the table. Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource on this bill today. I want to also thank Senator Chamberlain. I know that the amendment takes out the retroactivity, so much of the testimony we took out this morning because much of it was on the retroactivity.
Okay.
We thank the committee, and we thank Senator Chamberlain.
Wow. That was brief. We'll leave it at that.
He would have preferred not to have had that amendment, I can tell you. Go ahead, Mr. Cummings.
Members, this bill changes the requirements for the tax credit by expanding who can evaluate the child to include psychologists and requires the evaluation to find the child has dyslexia, a specific learning disability or deficit in basic reading skills, comprehension or fluency, or spelling, which does not need to impair their ability to meet expected age or grade level standards. Whatever anyone thought of the construction of the credit last year, the Department of Revenue really did work hard to make that tax credit work. To that end, we designed the forms and instructions to lead the taxpayer down a path to determine if they qualify, to break down the expenses for both the reading credit and the education credit so they could maximize the amount that they would receive from either credit. We held several meetings within the Department of Revenue with our legal team, our forms designs team, our communications group, and the people who would receive calls at the Department of Revenue to ensure that they had the up-to-date information. We had several conversations with experts on learning disabilities at the Department of Department of Education, some of which I sat in on. We tried to keep the form and instructions in a language that taxpayers who qualify for the credit would use rather than using tax terms. IEP, reading deficiency, treatment for reading deficiency, really aligning our terminology and training with the words that the taxpayer would be using. We defined as many of the qualifying criteria as possible while intentionally not defining things like what kind of treatment qualifies because we didn't want to exclude the possibilities. And this was very, you know, it was very difficult for us, Senator Ress, because, you know, to just to state the obvious, we are not experts on dyslexia. We reached out about the credit. We reached out on a conference call with tax practitioners. We presented in front of the Minnesota Association of Accountants, Public Accountants, the National Association of Tax Professionals, the Society of Enrolled Agents, and the Income Tax Short Course. And we're continuing to promote the credit. The credit is on the face of the form by the Working Family Credit and the K-12 credit. The majority of What's New section of the M1 booklet is dedicated to this reading credit. We updated our website and the tax law changes in the What's New area, the refundable tax credit area, the forms and instructions, and keyword searches. Developed a fact sheet. We wrote FAQs, frequently asked questions, trained volunteers at our VITA sites, and then also in upcoming newsletters. But, Madam Chair, as it relates to this tax credit in general, thinking about, as we were sort of thinking about the implementation, you know, we met with Representative Runbeck and Senator Chamberlain and suggested that they work with the Department of Education to understand the nexus between these issues and the students. To that end, we brought representatives from the Department of Education to our meeting. Using the instrument of a tax credit may not be the best tool to get at this issue, whereas providing resources, tools, or guidance for our schools may be the better approach. In addition, many tax credits like these are claimed by taxpayers who think they qualify, but then in the end do not. You know, we want to make sure that, you know, if this is something that the committee is going to make a priority, we want to continue to work with Senator Chamberlain and you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee to make the best approach possible for Minnesotans. I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Sure. Any questions for Mr. Cummings before he leaves? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Go back to the original testifier list then in order. And is it Ms. Conlon?
Yes.
Ms. Conlon, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Jane Conlon. I am a teacher in the school systems. I have over 30 years of experience, including experience working in special education. I own a tutoring center in St. Paul that works with families who we specialize in working with families who have dyslexic children or adults in their families. And I am the parent of a child who has dyslexia. Every day, I work with and I hear the stories, similar to the stories that you heard from Rachel first in our testimony, where their child is falling behind in school and they are not being taught in a way that is helping them to learn to read and learn to spell effectively using what's research-based for their child's learning disability. By the time these families get to me, they are very, very frustrated, and they have exhausted their resources and their options in the school system, and yet their child is continuing to fall behind. So what happens is the families are forced to look outside of the school system to get help for their child, and it puts incredible financial and emotional strain on these families as they struggle in their efforts. They are burdened not only with budgeting time 4 to 8 hours a week for tutoring, but financially securing thousands of dollars a year to pay for that tutoring. Some of the families have financial means to do that, but I can tell you that a lot of the families that are using our services and my tutoring center are giving up a lot of things in order to be able to afford to teach that child to read using our center. Many parents can't afford that outside support for their child, and that child is falling through the cracks in the school system. As a teacher, I've seen it in my classroom. I've seen it in the special ed department. I've seen it in the charter schools, in the private schools, and the public schools. We are not equipped to deal with these kids, and it's frustrating for us as well as the parents. Our parents are being asked to pay taxes to support the public schools, and then they have to pay again for outside tutoring for their child where the schools are not able to meet their needs. They're being stretched emotionally. They're being stretched financially. They are committed, responsible people. Every parent wants the best for their child. We need to support their efforts and the sacrifices that they're making. And this bill is going to supply at least a little bit of support for these families and the families who currently can't afford to get the extra help for their kids and that are paying twice for their children's education. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Conlon or comments? Seeing none, is it Ms. Smith?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to the committee. We're pleased to have your testimony. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Michaela Smith, and I am dyslexic. I attend Concordia University here in St. Paul as a freshman. I have made it pretty far on account of how much hard work and time I had to put in to get where I am today. And I want to share a particular memory, actually. I was in second grade, and I felt I never was going to be able to read or write. I felt as though I was going to be in second grade my entire life. Every day, a student was selected to go in front of the class and write spelling words. One day, I was selected and asked to write bread, walk, and time. It seems easy now, but second grade was pretty hard. And the month, which happened to be February, and I still struggle spelling that. I was up there for 15 minutes and began to cry because I kept trying, but kept getting it wrong. You see, I was diagnosed earlier that year with dyslexia. For me, this task was impossible because I was being asked to spell words that I couldn't sound out or read yet. Despite being diagnosed and getting special help, but not help specific to a child with dyslexia, I didn't learn to read a book until I was in fifth grade. The process was very slow. My teacher even once told my mom to hire a private tutor. This was not an option for my family. My parents love me very much, but I come from a family of four, and we aren't, we are quite low on the income scale. despite being diagnosed, our schools are not set up to help a dyslexic child the way he or she needs. Even though that was elementary school, I struggled with teachers and getting special help all the way up until high school. Special ed, if you are lucky enough to be held back enough to qualify, doesn't offer reading instruction, instruction that dyslexic needs to become adequate grade level reader. Sorry. I support the reading tax credit so that parents can help their children achieve in reading. Years can be saved.
Thank you, Ms. Smith, and congratulations on your success in school and in college. It's quite a remarkable achievement.
Thank you.
Are there questions or comments for any of the witnesses or Senator Chamberlain at this time? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was in, I don't know if any of the testifiers can answer this or Senator Chamberlain. I have kind of two questions. One, when we had met earlier, we talked about, and I just kind of want to reiterate for the record, that we you mentioned the gap, be it an achievement gap or not opportunity gap, and the number of kids in schools that are diagnosed with reading disabilities. Do we know or not able to read? Do we know how many people have there been any literature on how many, you know, kids in the state that are part of the gap that are not graduating from high school in a timely fashion? Do we know how many have reading disabilities? And I apologize if you mentioned that earlier. I didn't catch it.
Senator Chamberlain, do you have that information? Or
I don't have the reading disabilities in general, but I do know that
You need to go through the chair.
I'm sorry, for the record, that's all. I have to learn the system.
Okay. Sorry, just Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, and then everything's cool.
Madam Chair. I don't have specifically the general reading disabilities, but I do know that 1 in 5 children have dyslexia. Okay.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a follow-up, and this might be addressed somewhere else, but I know we had a discussion, and we did this last year, and then at some point we found out or it was felt that the money wasn't getting to the people that we wanted it to. Are in here anywhere, is there a report, or are we going to get something back so that we can again judge this in case we have to tweak it moving forward? Is there a report requirement in here or anything?
Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, last year's legislation included a report to be filed here the DOR to compile a report and report back to the tax committee on this. But the time frame was so short, and we had the IEP that nobody could really access it. So, yeah, it's there. But I would like to address one other thing too. Mr. Cummings was kind enough to talk to us about this, and as far as working with within the MDE, MDE has been within our meetings for the last 2 years. We've been meeting off and on, regularly monthly for 2 years. We tried to bring in all interests and concerned parties from higher ed, academics, specialists like Mrs. Conlon, and as well as MDE. The reading specialists were there for MDE, so they're all there. Second part of that is we do have another leg on this process and this whole project, and that is a literacy plan, and that was presented to K-12 finance. So we are working with MDE, and as I mentioned before, we've all discussed there's a gap here, there's some need here. I've been telling these good folks and these parents and these families that, you know, the tax credit is not the best approach, but for a stopgap, for some quick relief, it's certainly what we saw the best avenue, the best approach to it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion?
I'll ask one more question.
Oh, yes. Senator Dietzick,
go ahead. I appreciate that you've been meeting with MDE. Did they give any indication of when they might get around to acknowledging that this is an issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Deese.
Senator Chamberlain.
Well, I will be very careful with my comments regarding MDE. I have a slight bias, but there are people in MDE that are working hard. We have been working with a couple of people that are truly committed to fixing this. The reading specialist, Vicki, I cannot remember her last name, and Rachel and DDMN have been meeting with them outside of our regular meetings. So I believe they are committed to finding a fix and building the literacy plan. It kind of dovetails with that process a little bit. So they're aware of it. They are trying to do something, but it is a large bureaucracy, and we have to manage it appropriately.
Senator Dietzick, council informs me that the 2014 legislation required the report to be done March 1st of 2016, because we would have covered that tax year, and the proposed legislation does not ask the report to review the proposed changes. So, and they would be able to do that because there's the lag. You know, I mean, the proposed changes would be starting in 2015 since he removed the retroactive date, but just so we keep that in mind, although, you know, we may want to ask that a follow-up report, if the bill goes forward in the omnibus bill, a follow-up report come in and March 1st of 2017 that would reflect the impact of the changes. I mean, that we could do that and probably would do that, Senator Chamberlain, if we move forward on this.
I think that, Madam Chair, that would be instructive and helpful, yes.
Okay, is there further discussion or comments for the testifiers,
Madam
on
Chair?
271, Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Senator Chamberlain, did the bill go through Education Committee?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, yes, it has. Both pieces, the credit and the literacy piece, have been through K-12 finance and policy.
Madam Chair.
And that's reflected in the the face of the bill, that it went to education and then came here. But Senator Ortman, go right ahead.
Madam Chair, my question is similar to Senator Dietzick's, because this is clearly a workaround. It's not the best way to address what is a failing in the school system. And I wanted just to reinforce the fact that the solutions really should come from the Department of Education. It should come from our school districts. It should come from our education committee. And the fact that we all see a need to address this is a good thing, and it was a step forward. And as you know, I've met with you all and very supportive of what you're doing. But I hope we won't continue to fix the workaround, and we'll start to really address the underlying problem.
Senator Ortman, I think that's a point well taken. How do you go about getting the attention of the Minnesota Department of Education with regard to this issue? And this is indeed, in my opinion, a stopgap measure. It's not the way it should be done, but it was the alternative last year that was available to us, and so imperfect as it was, we went ahead with it. Would you agree, Senator Chamberlain?
Senator Rest and Senator Omar, I would agree, and again, we sincerely appreciate it, because it got the foot in the door, and we got some... It propelled us forward, so it was a good start, yes. And Ms. Berger would like to share.
Sure. Ms. Berger, did you want to make a final comment?
I did.
Ms.
Madam
Berger.
Chair, Senator Ortman, I very much understand that this isn't the best way to do this. I think Dietzick had made a comment about working with the Department of Education, et cetera, and that certainly is our goal. But I think
and pardon me, I mean no offense to anyone, but I think many of you might know that working in that manner can take a long time. And we're certainly working as hard as we can. We have their ear. I know that they are receptive. There are some things being done currently, but it's, in my mind, like turning the Titanic away from the iceberg. You know, I mean, it's gonna take some time and some movement, and we're simply trying to encourage the parents to continue to help their children and trying to offer some sort of relief. And again, just acknowledging that this is a problem, and I think we all have to be part of trying to provide a solution, and maybe all of us bearing some of that responsibility. We are working with the on our goals next year to identify the kids early, to provide the appropriate remediation, and to also work on some teacher professional development around this. So we do have further goals, definitely.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. I absolutely support what you're doing because you've taken real strides forward in addressing the problem, so I'm appreciative of all you've done. The reason I'm particularly concerned again this year is that I, for the first time last year, started serving on the Higher Ed Committee. And this year we heard of the dramatic numbers of students that are showing up at our state's colleges and universities requiring remediation. And I am now linking these two things together, wondering what is the problem and why are these students graduating without the ability to succeed at community college. And we had a testifier in higher ed who said she needed 9 courses, non-credit bearing, that she had to pay for in order to create readiness on her part to take college credits for courses, and yet she'd been given a diploma. So I am really concerned about the fact that this relates to that, and I'm seeing a major problem in the schools. And we owe it to the state of Minnesota to have a much bigger hand in creating oversight.
One more comment.
Ms. Berger.
Senator Ortman, that was me. As far back, we've been, it's through my son's diagnosis, we've been able to go back 4 generations now. I came out of high school with a diploma. It took me, I could not go to college. In fact, my guidance counselors advised me not to even apply. It wasn't a choice that was for me. I wasn't even able to make that choice. However, I decided I was going to go, and I applied to community college. I spent the first 2 years at community college taking remedial courses in math, writing, and reading. I paid for that. And I think if we can recognize sooner that there are implications and try to be part of that solution, we, again, stand to change some of that future outcome for those kids.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Chamberlain, and your witnesses. Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 271 as amended be laid over for further consideration of the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Chamberlain. We have your second bill, Senate File 1224, before us, which is an increase in the K-12 subtraction and credit. Senator Chamberlain, does this bill need any amendments?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain, then please proceed.
Madam Chair, this is, as someone mentioned earlier, this is fairly straightforward. It just addresses a current law. Simple idea, taking the current existing K-12 subtraction and credit and increasing it. It has not been increased for quite some time, if ever, so we are just trying to bring it up to date. About a 53% increase in the subtraction and about, a substantial increase in the credit from 1,000 to, what was it? I'm sorry. Maybe I lost my thought here. From 1,000 to 1,500, so that's a 50%. So it's about 50% either way. So it's that straightforward. We do put it, there is an inflation adjustment on this one. So we increase the subtraction, increase the credit, put the inflation adjustment on it. And you will see in your description, it does, of course, include the tuition piece for the credit. And I know that is a point of contention for some people, but I, given the conversation we've just had, I think we're trying to put kids and children and families first, their needs, that's what's important, putting some opportunities in their hands. I would ask that anybody here that's left in this committee room that is in front of me or behind me, if they have a kid that's trapped in a failing school and their school is only graduating 50% of the kids or 40, 80% of the kids and their reading proficiency is 40 or 50%, that you would hope to find a better operation, better program, better opportunities for that child. If any of us were put in that position, I think we'd do it. So I'd like, I just ask for due consideration of that part of it, the tuition, adding the tuition as a component of the eligible for the credit. So that's it. Simple, increasing a couple of the numbers and adding the inflation adjustment as well as the tuition. Thank you, Madam.
Okay, we have a few testifiers on this. Ms. Doslin and Mr. Kroonquist, and then Ms. Schwab Kelleher. And Senator Clausen, you're quite right. There are some of us that would, I mean, Chamberlain, why am I doing that?
Who did you call me now?
I called him Chamberlain, you Clausen,
I was
sorry about that.
All for the last 2 years.
So. You're both handsome men, so, you know, I get confused. So, Senator Chamberlain, I think you're quite right that some of us would stumble over the tuition rather than just a simple increase. Mr. Kroonquist, you want to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And thank you for the opportunity to offer a few comments. We do have concerns, Madam Chair and members, about extending the tax credit to private school tuition. That was discussed when this legislation was originally approved back in the 90s, and the legislature at that time made a very conscious decision to not include private school tuition as eligible for the tax credit, and I think that was at least partly due to a previous court decision. Now, I know legal scholars may disagree from time to time. You know, if you ask three legal scholars whether or not it would withstand a constitutional scrutiny now, you might get three different opinions. And I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to weigh in on that. Quite frankly, I think that we don't even get to that discussion, because I think if you look at the state constitution, which clearly says that it's the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools, I think if we stop right there and examine whether or not we're doing that in Minnesota currently, I think the answer is no. We have a $600 million special education cross-subsidy. We have a basic formula allowance that is $1,000 per pupil behind where it should be had it simply kept pace with inflation. And so I would submit, Madam Chair members, that before we even entertain a notion of extending a tax credit to private school tuition, that we should first focus on funding our public schools and living up to that constitutional duty. So I will leave it at that, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Mr. Kroonquist. Ms. Doslin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Doslin. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And I would just echo Mr. Kroonquist's concerns, especially in light of the fact that we are fighting and we are advocating as strongly as we can on the per pupil formula this session in the E-12 budget. I would also just like to add, it's interesting that this bill includes an inflationary factor for the credit and deduction, and we would certainly like to entertain that conversation on the per pupil formula as well. So thank you.
And we won't comment on the likelihood of success in either, okay? Ms. Schwab. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. We do have concerns about the credit portion of the bill. This is the area where the tuition comes out that we've got concerns. We want to share with you that there is an awful lot of money invested here. And, you know, very rarely does the House or the Senate sit around and count numbers of how much bills cost. But this is $22 million a year. That's a lot of money. And we, the legislature, in their wisdom last year, provided a lot of new challenges for school districts. And we are struggling to fund those. They include increased expectations for the world's best workforce, college and career-ready standards, statewide teacher evaluation, statewide kindergarten implementation, health insurance transparency act for our employees, stronger human resource requirements, using technology for our testing requirements, Safe and Supportive Schools Act, pensions, and closing the achievement gap. So that's what we are presently, that we are charged with doing additionally last year. And I just really encourage you to think strongly about giving K-12 the money we need to do that match up with the expectations the legislature has for us. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Mr. Bartholomew? Please identify yourself again for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I apologize for being unannounced. I wasn't sure I'd be able to make it. But we'd like to speak in support of Senate File 1224, and in particular the education tax credit provisions. We support updating both the income eligibility as well as the credit amounts. It's been nearly 17 years since these were set, and an update is certainly appropriate. And hopefully future adjustments will be made more frequently than this, though not through the use of automatic inflation factors. The updates in Senate File 1224 are going to help families with educational expenses such as tutoring, music lessons, and technology. We do support the expansion of the credit to include tuition, as this will help equalize options for lower-income families who believe that a non-public school may better meet the needs of their children. From our perspective, the research that's looked at the effectiveness of expanding school choices shows a positive impact both for schools as well as for the students who participate. Again, we ask that you support Senate File 1224 to provide much-needed updates to a program that helps lower-income families provide educational options for their families, or for their students, pardon me.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Are there comments or questions? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a great bill. I carried this bill in 2004 with different numbers, and it actually passed to the DFL Majority Senate in 2004 to the credit of many people that worked very hard to help the Senate understand that parents need options when their kids are failing in the public school system. And we've heard some of that testimony here. So how many students like Ms. Smith are we going to fail or allow to fail in the system before we give some parents the option to choose something different, especially those that are in the lower income brackets where a tax credit like this will make all the difference? And the tax credit makes a lot of sense versus a voucher because the voucher creates the incentive, which probably does have constitutional ramifications, but a tax credit follows on the parents' initiative. There's no change from the state unless the parent first has invested and made a decision to get a different educational outcome for their children. And we had very powerful testimony back in 2004 of a young lady who had three children. She was a single mom, and her son came home with gang markings on his arms, and she wanted him out of that school and would never have been able to afford moving her child to another school if there weren't a tax credit. She didn't qualify within the current income levels. Parents need options, and I hope everyone that testified would agree that in most cases, the parents know best what the children need and are good advocates for their children. I heard a lot of opposition to this bill back in 2004, and the story went like this. Well, don't give these parents options. It's better to improve our public schools. Let's focus on improving the public schools, the per pupil formula. Let's make our public schools better. Well, nobody disagrees with that. Of course we want the public schools to be better.
But that's not the right answer here. The right answer is to empower parents and families to help their children get the education they need in order to be successful. And I don't think the public school should be allowed to fail all these students in achieving their educational goals and all these families without presenting an option like this. And so, Senator Chamberlain, I know it's not easy to carry this legislation, but I really appreciate the fact that you are, and I'm here to help in any way I can.
Madam Chair.
Senator Chamberlain.
And Madam Chair, Senator Orman, I thank you for the support. As you found out in 04, I can't say any more. It's simple. It's a simple concept, simple idea. I sometimes, as an aside, regret leaving tax committee for K-12. I sleep less at nights. It's much more emotional. I love tax, but that's a little more emotional. So I sometimes regret that, but I have a great amount of respect for our colleagues and friends over at TIES, but I simply ask them to check in with us and our policies that we've presented this year, and they might find some relief for them in that and thereby support some other opportunities for parents. But I cannot leave without saying I just saw another piece of data from Minneapolis. Minneapolis Public Schools, 23% of the black students are reading at proficiency. That hasn't changed in 10 years. And the people from TIES come here and say, no, don't do this. These parents are trapped in these schools. No options, no opportunities. You trap them in the schools and create a monopoly. We wouldn't want the government telling us we had to buy their cell phones or buy their cars. We wouldn't give the government a monopoly on that, but we say it's perfectly fine to give them a monopoly on something much more complicated and much more important to us, our children. So that's my impassioned plea to actually consider this opportunity to break this logjam. Competition does not mean absence of quality. They're not mutually exclusive. They can work together. But this idea that the solutions lie in just this one place is troubling. So I appreciate the time, Madam Chair, and your and the opportunity to present the two bills. And I just hope that we can somehow think out of the box, as Senator Ortman and others have suggested. So thank you very much for your time. I'll end with that.
Senator Chamberlain, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to have this discussion. It certainly is one that we need to revisit from time to time, even though we may have different paths to achieving the same goals. Senator Thompson, I note that you're a co-author, and so would you move the bill? So Senator Thompson moves that Senate File 1224 be laid over for further consideration of the Omnibus Tax Bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
You bet. What's this? Oh, yeah. So tomorrow, the full committee will be meeting at 8:30 again, and we will be taking up local aid bills. The division next week will meet on Monday and Wednesday, and the agendas will be set today. There being no further business before the committee, we're adjourned.